So may I continue? Well, you will reply once you get the floor, Mr. Chairman. I trust that we will apply the same discipline to the Honorable Jeffrey and the Honorable Smith. Now, having said that, I concur with what John is saying, especially because what we are doing here, we are limiting the assets upon which there can be execution to movable property, which I think is the wrong thing to do, but being as it may, it is possible that there are organs of state which the assets of which consist exclusively of immovable properties. So by having this type of provision, one would bar the possibility of recovery from those organs of state unless the national and provincial treasury step in, which would upset the entire scheme of the PMFA, where the scheme is such as to prevent that the liability of such organs of state would automatically become the liability of the state. But if that's the direction we go to, I think we should have an application provision and transform the definition of state into a provision at the beginning that says this act applies only to, and then the definition follows. This act applies only to, blah, 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 national and provincial departments listed in Schedule 1 and 2 of the Public Service 1994, respectively. It's a subsequent law that would make it unnecessary to amend all the other laws, because they would make reference to the State Liability Act. The State Liability Act is read, and the State Liability Act says this law applies only to these departments and nothing else. But we would need an application clause or scope of application clause.
Well, members, I'll recognize the announcement. I think we're going to have to apply our minds to this and come to a decision. All right, particularly given the ideas that have surfaced. We can't leave it to Mr. Labuschagne. It's our decision to take. All right, Mr. Gold.
Thanks, Chair. I think two things that we need just to apply ourselves. One is only Section 3 of the State Liability Act was declared unconstitutional. Only Section 3. The rest of the sections are still applicable until such time we have amended the entire Act. Now, if you go to Section 4 of the old State Liability Act, says nothing in this Act contained shall affect any provision of any law which A. limits the liability of the state or national government or provincial government or any department thereof in respect of any act or mission of its servants. Now, the definition there in terms of the saving clause, which is 4, is adequately considered by Judge Mokoro, as referred to on page 22, that a reservation made by both ALP and FOL concerns the inclusion of an attachment execution procedure against property of local government in the proposed order. This inclusion, they correctly point out, is unnecessary, as Section 3 of the State Liability Act does not regulate the execution of judgment debts against local government. There are pieces of legislation, for example, the Local Government Municipal Financial Management Act deals with the process with respect to what steps to be taken when a particular local government fails to comply or to fulfill its financial obligations. So that act deals, covers that.
Okay. I'm trying to expand because some of the bodies fall within the competences of local government. There are other bodies that fall within the competence of provincial and national government.
Us getting into the situation where we're going to ask you to present us the list of bodies, and I really didn't want to do that. But all right.
Chair, my concern is that if we now are making changes to the bill that weren't in the initial law, we're going to end up with problems with public participation and all kinds of other things. Now, if the organs of state were of the view that they didn't have to worry because the Act applied to them in terms of their legislation, and now we're suddenly saying it's not going to apply to them, then they're going to be negatively affected by that. And surely they would then have the right to come and give us comments on it. So I'm very worried now about, I don't know if we've really thought this through enough, actually, before, which maybe we should have, but you know, to now come at this late stage and make substantial amendments to the bills and then start changing other acts as well that apply to those organs. I think we're entering some dangerous territory here.
I don't share Debbie's concern. I mean, the State Liability Act was being amended. Anybody subject to the State Liability Act, or the State Liability Act applied to, knew they had an interest. Okay? We are the ones who put in this definition of clarifying that it only applies to national and provincial departments as, we put in this definition of state. There was no definition of state in the original bill, Schedules 1 and 2, the Public Service Act. But look, I mean, the State Liability Act is pretty short and it's got only four clauses. I think clause one remains the same. Then we've changed clause one, have we? Clause two, we are then adding these sections about which was there before. Proceedings to be taken against minister or department concerned, and that really applies to what we're dealing with. So I don't know what happens with the Mr. Lovescottney given. You didn't have the Johannesburg Zoo. Maybe you can just give one example of the more sort of on the edges.
It's a useful example, and that is one thing that the Lord was and myself discussed this morning. If you look, for example, the public protector, the State Liability Act shall apply with the necessary changes in respect of the office of the public protector, and in such application reference in that act, in the State Liability, to quote it, the Minister of the Department concerned, as it is in the state, present State Liability, shall be construed as a reference to the Public Protector. If you look, for example, at the Human Rights Commission, Minister of the Department, reference as Chairperson. I'm not sure, Chairperson, because the most that I picked up are well known, as it mentioned, all the Chapter 9s, Electoral Commission, even the Special Investigating Unit is covered, or the State Liability is made applicable. So we have, the Lord Wises and myself will have to go and sit and make a list if the committee requires, which is hopefully not the case of all the institutions.
I seem to remember that the South Africa Reserve Bank Act has got such a provision, and here is not just an issue of what is marginal, as John is suggesting, the Zoo or the Natal Park, the Natal Shark Board. It's the different type of operation. I mean, on the one hand, for instance, the Reserve Bank is given total operational autonomy from the rest of the state structure, and on the other hand, there would be the state structure wouldn't need to be financially responsible for the satisfactions of its debt. It doesn't really quite fit.
Judge Rader's argument strengthened my concern, because the fact of the matter is that if we had this bill, we advertised it a certain way. There was no limitation then of state. So if I were an organ of state, I would have thought, well, this act applies to me, therefore the State Liability Act would apply to me, therefore whatever happens here is going to be the same for all of us. If we are now limiting the state according to the constitutional definition, then that is negatively affecting them. It's certainly affecting them. And I would like the legal advisors to apply their minds to that issue as well, because, you know, precisely, and now they're saying it can be, so that is negatively affecting. Now they're saying that you can attach this stuff, so it is negatively affecting. So if I could just give some of the thought to that problem.
The concept of the state appears in the Constitution in many, many ways, and one would have to look at that quite well. Organ of state, just because we're seized with it for the purposes of the other bill in intelligence, is not the only reference. I mean, you would have to look at it quite carefully about how the Bill of Rights treats the state. There are different treatments in different chapters, and you'd have to look at that quite carefully. I don't think we would get too hung up on the organs of state, but I address only that little point.
Can I suggest that we discuss that the advisors discuss this with National Treasury once we break? Because I think the whole process must fit into what we thought we could do, the process of execution. JJ is correct, you know, we must be sure that it fits into what we think the process should be in terms of the State Liability Act. Each structure, each organ has a responsible minister. For example, the public protector. I mean, the responsible minister there is really the Minister of Justice, who looks at their legislation and deals with their budget, but not affecting the impartiality and so forth. So we must just look at that and consider how that scenario fits into the State Liability Bill that we're now considering, and then also the role of National Treasury. How would they fit into that process and this relevant structure that we're talking about?
I think we need to see this list of these bodies to know what we're dealing with. Yeah.
We might miss one or two, but we'll try our best to get all those organs.
Thank you. sorry, just one suggestion, and that is on page 4, in subclause 4, the one reading, if a final court order against the department for payment of money is not satisfied within 30 days of the date of judgment, I suggest that we substitute the word judgment with the date of the order becoming final, because the whole time we're talking about final court order. So that's a suggestion that the Lord Bishop and myself discussed this morning. To substitute the word judgment with the date of the order becoming final.
I don't know what this, the whole thing is. Oh, I think we've moved to 5.
Are we done with 4?
Yeah, we suggested, Chair, that from sub 4 onwards, that perhaps National Treasury can go through those provisions. Yeah.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I guess we can begin at subsection 5, which provides that the relevant treasury would then be required within 14 days of service of the final court order, and then proposed wording has been included to say as provided for in subsection 4, to provide a clear linkage with the time frames that are set out there. And the relevant treasury within that time frame would be required to ensure that the judgment debt is, and the proposed wording is proposed to change to read satisfied instead of settled. And then in B, or acceptable arrangements have been made with the judgment creditor for the satisfaction, that's another proposed wording changes instead of settlement, of the judgment debt, should there be inadequate funds available in the vote of the department concerned. So that sets out the clear obligations on Treasury. And then what would be, as was discussed in the last meeting, the subsection 6, which was in the last, the previous version of the bill has been deleted. And what would now become subsection 6 then provides for what happens. Sorry?
A very strong objection to this crossed out subsection 6 here. This was not in a previous draft of the bill. It was an amendment that Janine came with on the last day, which we solidly rejected. So it shouldn't be here at all, even for us to look at. That was the one about Treasury doesn't have to comply with a court order if it doesn't agree with it. So basically, and I think my problem, an overall problem with the wording, this has got to be an amendment to the bill. So the section should refer, and the addition should refer to the bill. So for example, this 6 is from a proposed amendment. I don't know if Janine wanted Mr. Novala to see it so that he could see she's
no.
Tried.
No. I think this document had been drafted so that it reflected all changes from the previous working draft that was discussed in the previous meeting. So that is why it's reflected as being crossed out.
I failed to understand what JJ's point is. 6 has been taken out. the six is what used to be the seven. Oh, it's actually upset that even the image. Oh, it should have not even been. Oh, I see.
I mean, look, my understanding is we're actually dealing with amendments to the introduced bill. So amendments that some or other official may have proposed that they were rejected. It was a horrific proposal of like, if Treasury doesn't feel like instituting a court or complying with a court order, we won't. Ambrosini, is it correct for a member to address the chair while she's got a mouthful of food?
Yeah. Okay, so moving on to what is now subsection 6, that provides that what happens if a final court order is not satisfied or acceptable arrangements have not been made within the periods specified in subsection 3A, 1 or 2, then and some proposed additional wording has been included here. The registrar or clerk of the court concerned, as the case may be, may, upon the written request of the judgment creditor or his or her legal representative, issue a writ of execution or a warrant of execution in terms of the applicable rules of court against movable property owned by the state and used by the department concerned. So that is how it's proposed that subsection would read. And
We had agreed that we raise questions as we go along, so I'm assuming there's nothing.
And then subsection 7 would read, subject to paragraph B, the sheriff of the court concerned must, pursuant to the writ of execution or the warrant of execution, as the case may be, attach but not remove movable property owned by the state and used by the department concerned. Paragraph B would provide
I'm just wondering whether used by the department concerned is the correct phrase. I mean, could we not maybe just say owned by the state and belonging to the department concerned? Something like that. Owned by the state. Oh, right. Well, yeah, okay, I see the point, but this sounds a bit funny. Because, yeah, it almost sounds like we're contradicting ourselves if it's being used by the department. Then it's necessary for them to be using it, you know what I mean? But maybe not. Just think about it.
Now, Mr. Chairman, just as a recorder, I really think we're making much more complicated and making a disservice to the very purposes we're trying to serve by eliminating immovable property, because once one attaches immovable property, it takes forever to be sold and there is no disruption in the action, in the delivery of services.
Thank you. And paragraph B provides for that the sheriff and the accounting officer of the department concerned or an official of his or her department designated in writing by him or her may, in writing, agree on the immovable property owned by the state and used by the department concerned that may not be attached, removed, and sold in execution of the judgment debt because it will severely disrupt service delivery, threaten life, or put the security of the public at risk. Paragraph C would provide, if no agreement referred to in paragraph B is reached, then the sheriff may attach any movable property owned by the state and used by the department concerned, the proceeds of the sale of which, in his or her opinion, will be sufficient to satisfy the judgment debt against the department concerned. So that those two paragraphs deal with how the debt would be, how the execution would occur.
Thank you, Chairperson. So in other words, the principle is the sheriff may attach anything. That was a proposal from the committee. May attach anything, but then he and the accounting officer may agree and say, but listen, you can't attach that, we can't attach that. If no agreement, he can still attach. But then, if that's the case, the proposed in subsection 10 kicks in, where the party having an interest may then go to the court and ask for a stay of execution. So it's there is, if the accounting officer and the sheriff can't reach an agreement, then the department can still go to court. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. So I think Mr. Lapiskakny has summarized the content of subsection 8 and 9 and 10, which provides for that process for making an application if in respect of the proposed execution of movable property. Subsection 10 particularly provides that a party having a direct and material interest may, before the attached movable property is sold in execution of the judgment debt, apply to the court which granted the order for a stay on grounds that the execution of the attached movable property would severely disrupt service delivery, threaten life, or put the security of the public at risk, or is not in the interest of justice. And paragraph B provides, if an application referred to in paragraph A is brought by the department concerned, the application must contain a list of movable property and the location thereof compiled by the department concerned that may be attached and sold in execution of the judgment debt. And paragraph C provides requirements for notice of an application that must be given to the judgment creditor and the sheriff concerned. And then subsection 11 sets out various empowering provisions for the National Treasury to allow it to effectively comply with its obligations in terms of subsection 5, and generally to ensure that final court orders are satisfied by departments without delay. And so the various steps that the relevant treasuries are empowered to take are to issue appropriate regulations, instructions, circulars, guidelines, and reporting rules, issuing directives to make a payment or of a court order, to conduct investigations, issue instructions, to take remedial action or obtain specified support if there has been noncompliance with this act by a department or relevant regulations, instructions, circulars, guidelines, or directives, or if there is identified that there is a need for intervention in light of the state of the financial governance or management situation in the department. And the treasuries are also empowered to withhold from a department's voted funds, sufficient funds to provide for the satisfaction of any outstanding final court order, which funds may only be released to the department upon the submission of proof acceptable to the relevant treasury that the court order in question has been satisfied. And
we had a constitutional query about that. Has that been dealt with? Can I just ask? whether Treasury had the constitutional competence to withhold funds on this basis.
I would like to expand on the question.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, what is happening here on E, F, and G, the language accurately describes what happens in practice. That's how the Treasury organizes its function of distributing the money, the budgetary cycle, and they take money back, they give money back, etc., and readjust. Except for the fact that all these must result into a law, either an appropriation law or an appropriation adjustment law. When you have the word, and I'm just articulating what the constitutional question is, not answering. When you have the word here, departments voted funds. Voted means voted in the law of this parliament, which enables money to be taken out of the National Revenue Fund and given to a department as for an expenditure. The fundamental principle or constitutional principle in taxation and appropriation is that the money is taxed and is given for a purpose on the basis of a program. Now, we would be giving the authority in EFG to a department, to the Treasury, to bypass the constitutional requirements, amend unilaterally, surely for a good reason, but amend unilaterally or disregard the provision of the appropriation law that we pass every year, including subsequent appropriation laws, taking money allocated for purpose A to pay creditor B. I don't think this can be done. I think that all this should come out, EFG, and all this should be summarized in a section that says take appropriate measures, if necessary, to submit to Parliament an adjustment, an appropriation adjustment bill.
Chair, we dealt with this question when a question was raised whether a department can budget for an impending court order, and a department can make that budget. Now, if the department for some reason did not anticipate that there would be a court judgment, there is already a provision in the PFMA for unforeseen and unavoidable that allows that appropriated funds may be used in those circumstances. And then if that was an eventuality, then there is again a provision that allows that be tabled in subsequent budgets appropriately. So should anything that is contained in this clause fall within that category of issues, that process would kick in. What this clause is talking about is a situation that allows that whoever the judgment creditor is, and irrespective of the circumstances, that person be paid, and that's what has been cried for by the Mohoro judgment, that departments with obligations, genuine obligations, they don't meet those obligations, whether they're appropriated or not appropriated, and what then gets done. A plea has been made to the Treasury that Treasury ensure this happens. Now, what the Treasury is saying here is that, and this is the point we argued, that we can't take the money from another department and pay on behalf of that department. What we put in place here is that we will only do that payment as the final result. But we will withhold money and then force the department to pay. Only when the department gives you proof that this has been paid then you can allow, you can release that money to the department. But that's the treasury you're not paying. So the clause up until this point, treasury is not taking any money from any department. It's forcing the department to meet an obligation. So treasury is not bypassing any appropriation act. Now the act of the department, the act of the department that led to the final order has already happened at the point we are talking about. So if there is anything that violates the Appropriation Act, is the actions of the accounting officer of that department that led to the final court order. And that has happened. What is left now is that must be met. And the rules in terms of the PPMA must be followed by the department in relation to that. What this legislation is doing is to create an avenue for the satisfaction of that obligation that arises out of that act. But the act that results in what the Honourable Member is talking about would have taken place already, and it would have taken place in the department. And what we're crafting here is to make sure that even the settlement of an obligation that arises out of that act is in fact carried out by the department, but you put a mechanism to force the department to do so. So this is not any violation of an Appropriation Act.
I see you, all of you. As I understand you then, Mr. Nomvalo, what will happen is that the department will be put in a situation where it is forced to satisfy, right? It must pay. And only then, having done so, will you as Treasury then say, okay, here's the money. Rather, as opposed to having Treasury go to the judgment creditor and say, here's the money that the court wants from Department A. I think that's what Treasury is saying will actually happen logistically. All right. First, Mr. Ambrosini, then Steve Swart, and then
Mr. Chairman,
JJ, and then Debbie.
We had the same answer the last time, and it is, with due respect, a non-responsive answer, and it contains a confusion. Let us simplify for our common understanding. We pass a law in which we put into a department taxpayers' money to buy oranges, pears, and apples. The department should budget for liability from judgment. If he has done so, no problem. If he falls under the contingency funds, no problem. We are dealing here with a case in which the department, for whatever reason, did not budget. Because if he did budget, then A, B, C, D kick in, and they can be instructed, ordered, treasured, banged over the head, and they can do it. Here it can't, because the department is bound by a law of parliament which tells them that the money they've been given, the taxpayers' money they've been given, can only be used for apple, pears, and oranges, nothing else. If they want to change it, they must come back to us with an adjustment bill through the treasury. Now we are giving instead authority to the treasury to ignore the law of parliament and use the money which we allocated for apple, pears, and oranges, and use it to satisfy a judgment and withhold more money that we may give in the future. Again, for those three aforesaid fruit, to pay that. I submit that we cannot give, and those laws are constitutionally required, are laws part of a constitutional scheme which embodies the principle of no taxation without representation, and that we allocate the money to the taxpayer for one purpose and we alone can do it. We alone can authorize the expenditure. Here we give to an organ of state the power to organize, to authorize an expenditure, a very legitimate one, no doubt, but bypassing these things. I don't think it can be done. I think all that can be done is to ask them to promptly submit to Parliament an adjustment bill to then ABC. Then the E becomes submit to Parliament an adjustment bill, and the DFG becomes sub-items under that, which clarify what the adjustment bill is about. Is to withhold, is to pay on behalf of the department, and to debit the cost associated. That's what the adjustment will do. But you still need to have, I submit, Mr. Chairman, a law of parliament. It can be done any time on matter of urgency.
It was that a special appropriation can be done at any time. So with the floods or the World Cup, we do a special appropriation. So we don't wait for the adjustments appropriation, which is, I mean, the normal cycle is we do an appropriation and then we do one adjustment in October. A special appropriation can be done at any time. But while I'm on the floor just to cheat and upset Mr. Swart, I mean, my question was going to be, and it might help, are we giving, and it's quite brief, are we giving Treasury in E, F, and G powers that they currently do not have? Yeah, well, I'll just put it a little bit more succinctly than Dr. Rossini. The crisp issue is to what degree of our departments at present budgeting for contingent liabilities litigation. I think they're not. And so you've also got to protect Treasury, because the other alternative is, with the budgetary constraints we've got at the moment with a deficit on our budget, you might have departments trying to think, well, we'll just get an adjustment appropriation. So they don't build it into their budget at the moment, and they assume that they will just get that additional funds. Take police, for example. They've got a massive litigation cost. So they say, well, other departments now are using an adjustment appropriation to get their cost. Let's do the same for us. We don't budget it and we apply for it. So it's a double-edged sword. We've got to be very careful. Yes, I agree that we would need to go the route and ascertain whether we're giving Treasury extra funds, extra powers. But on the other hand, Treasury has got a pie that it allocates. We can't allow departments then to rely on the adjustment appropriation at a later stage. The answer is clearly, we've got to have departments know at the point when the summons is issued, they've got to build in those contingent liabilities like the RAF does, and says, this is, we've got 10 billion rands contingent liabilities that have to be budgeted for somehow. That's the way forward, and it's going to take some time. Because I don't think departments budget for that contingent liability of not only judgment debt, which we're dealing with here, but the legal costs. The state attorney pays the legal costs, and it's recovered at a later stage. There were particularly counsel's fees. That's not budgeted at all.
So, Chair, it wasn't only that issue about the adjustment of the appropriation bill, it was also Section 216 of the Constitution, which says specifically that Treasury must enforce compliance with the measures established in terms of subsection 1 may stop the transfer of funds to an organ of state if that organ of state commits a serious or persistent material breach of those measures. Section 3 then goes on to say a decision to stop the transfer of funds due to a province may only be done under certain circumstances, which includes no longer than 120 days. That was the other issue.
Very interesting. Who needs to look at 216?
Yeah.
It's partially answered, but I'd like Treasury to answer. Is EFG, it would seem then from the section that Debbie has read that you have the powers under E. But just to clarify, because that's going to really be the issue. Obviously, if we're giving you new powers against departments, that's going to be problematic. Tell us if you have these powers already. And generally, PFMA or the Constitution, that would be the thing for me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. E, F, G describe the power that the Treasury has, not in law, but in fact. As Steve beautifully put it, the there is a pie. They control the budgetary cycle. It seems to, it's going to be a fruit pie, but the, and they decide how that pie is going to be allocated. If a department misspends its pie, it's going, its slice of pie is going to have to argue very hardly the next time around for the same slide, and it may have less. So this is effectively what they do, but they don't have the legal power. And by giving them the legal power, I submit there is a constitutional problem. So in as a matter of fact, these things are taken care of without us having to provide in legislation by the Treasury exercising this power, this type of powers. The provision that David was referring to, 216, I don't think it comes necessarily into application a situation of this nature. And it does not override the allocation given by Parliament. There you have, it is provided for a situation where money is spent for, it is to be spent for a purpose. It is not spent for the purpose, it's not spent in accordance with the PMFA, it is withdrawn. And then there are other mechanisms which enable the at the provincial level, at the local government level, there is a national intervention, it's part of corrective schemes. But that would not authorize, I submit, the possibility of withholding and using that money for different purposes. Here there isn't a breakdown in the exercise of a function. They're buying apples, pears, and oranges. There is nothing wrong with the exercise of those functions. It's the fact that they haven't paid a debt. So there isn't, the case that we are dealing with is not a breakdown of financial accountability in the exercise of functions where 216 would kick in.
Chair, I think there's a few points. The members will pardon me because I might just stay on the platform a little bit longer. I'll try and be brief. First, Mr. Ambrosini moves from a premise, and this is what he has said, that we are dealing with a situation here where a department did not budget. And I think that is not true. We are dealing here with a situation whether the department budgeted or didn't budget. That aspect of whether there's a budget or no budget is not an issue. The issue that this legislation is addressing is a situation where a department failed to honor an obligation that that department had. As a result of failing to honor that obligation, the creditor goes and seeks assistance of the courts in ensuring that the department honors that. That is the issue we're addressing, not whether there is a budget or there is no budget. Now, and again, he's just said no, but that to me is the understanding that I have of what we're trying to address here. In the case of Nyati, there needed to be a service provided to this individual which was not provided, and as a result there was an obligation. A department had to honor the decision of the court that it must pay this person. The issue is not whether there was money budgeted or not. The issue was whether the department did in fact honor that obligation and pay. And the department did not honor the obligation and pay. And that's the question that brings us to dealing with this legislation, where people then say, if the obligations that the state has are not fulfilled, what recourse do we have? Section 3 of the State Liability Act of 1956 did not allow members of the public to take state property in order to ensure that their obligations are fulfilled. Now, the question of then making available in the budget those funds is a question that every person that has an obligation must in fact do. And it's quite different to what the legislation is trying to address. And as a matter of fact, in sub-clause 15b, we are stating that the department must in fact make provision for this, because we recognize that there is a process through which money is allocated and given to specific activities. That's the first point that I want to make, Chair. The second point is the point that Mr. Ambrosini is making about we are making the Treasury use the money for a purpose of that other than that which for it was budgeted. Again, it's not a proper way of looking at this thing. Let's assume a department has an obligation and in fact they do pay. What gives rise to the obligation to even pay is what the department did or did not do. And that's what gives rise to the application of the funds to a particular purpose. Now, what the Treasury is asked to do here is the fulfillment of that last step, not committing the budget of a department. Committing the budget of a department is what violates the Appropriation Act. So, an activity by a department that results in an obligation by a department to have to pay, in other words, if the police kick and shoot an innocent person and as a result that person goes and games, and then that claim ends up being settled by the Treasury. By settling that claim, Treasury did not commit the funds. It is the actions of the policeman that resulted in the funds being committed in that way. So an act that results in the money being used for a purpose other than is the act of that policeman. The final step of ensuring that whoever is entitled to that payment in fact does receive payment is not committing funds. And that is not helping the process of dealing with this matter if we're going to look at it from that angle. Now, there is a question whether Treasury does have an obligation to withhold funds. Again, there's an obligation on the part of the Treasury which flows from the Constitution that it must enforce norms and standards that flow from the legislation. There's a legislation that says all obligations, invoices, as well as court orders must be paid within 30 days. And if they are not paid within 30 days, Treasury must take steps to do so. Now, the Constitution makes reference to one scenario, and that scenario is consistent breakdown, is a breakdown of serious or consistent breaches. And if somebody has disrespected the laws of the country and did not pay his obligation, I think that is serious. These pieces of legislation arise out of this Constitution. And therefore the right to withhold funds is already covered in the Constitution. It's not something new. The only thing that is new is the clause that we haven't, the subclause that we haven't read, which says that in the event that the department doesn't pay, we withhold funds, and the period is expiring, and there is no evidence that the department has paid, and the final result is that the Treasury would pay. We've been reluctant to do that as the Treasury, as you will recall. But the community has been unhappy that the Treasury is reluctant to do that, and the Treasury will do it, because that's what is going to help ensure that people get paid. The parts that are now being in dispute are not the parts that are a problem at all. In fact, the manner in which we've crafted this will, in the ultimate analysis, ensure that the Treasury doesn't have to do that which, in fact, may fall outside of the powers of the Treasury by forcing the Department not to have those funds until they are paid. Now, yes, this is the last issue that I must address. Now, let's assume a Department commits these funds and then they pay. It doesn't mean that there is a viable source. It doesn't mean that they won't get an adjustment budget. What then happens you've got a budget that's, say, 2 billion rands, and then you end up with 500 million rands lawsuit. You pay it, you go with an unauthorized expenditure. The two things that the members talk about, one, unauthorized expenditure because of overspend, or unauthorized expenditure because you've used money for a purpose other than, that's covered in the PFMA. That matter gets dealt with by SCOPA. So the PFMA has got a process to deal with that. It gets dealt with by SCOPA. SCOPA examines the circumstances in which that has happened. If SCOPA is happy, that activity will be approved. Now, SCOPA will be saying, we are fine, we understand what you've done, and we think it was a sensible thing to do. But SCOPA can also say, we don't think you did the right thing. This is not acceptable, we are not approving it. Those are the first two decisions that SCOPA will take. When SCOPA approves, SCOPA also decides whether this is a matter that requires that the department be given additional funds. Whereas the budget of that department for the future gets increased by the amount of that unauthorized expenditure. That is the decision that is taken by Parliament, not by the Treasury, to increase the budget of the department or not to increase the budget of the department. Whether this action is acceptable or not acceptable, again, is a decision that is taken by SCOPA, which is Parliament, which is the Court of Parliament. All this legislation is doing is that whatever that activity that has taken place, acceptable or otherwise, in the eyes of SCOPA, result in an obligation on the state for the state to pay somebody. And all this legislation is doing is that that person receives the money, and the conduit through which that gets done is the Treasury. So all of the things that the Honorable Ambrosin is talking about, I don't know them in our legislation. I don't see them in this piece of legislation.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think Mr. Nomvalo has just elaborated quite well on the thought that has been going through my mind, that we are discussing here something, debating something that is already permissible, because the very idea that it is constitutionally permissible for a property of the state to be attached, removed, and sold in execution indicates that there will be instances where money that has been allocated for something else is used for something else, because that very property was intended for a specific purpose, not for it to be sold in order to satisfy a judgment debt. So therefore, it's logical that there will be instances where money is going to be taken to be used for some other purpose other than the purpose for which it was voted for. And in any event, the adjustment and so on are in a position to regularize those things, including the route of SCOPA to satisfy itself for on behalf of Parliament that this was a sensible thing to do or not. There's no way of avoiding the use of money or property, because the property itself is money because it was bought. That was just my thought. Let's go to somebody else.
Thank you. I always feel uncomfortable to speak after Nkosi. I don't want to rehash, but I think we may need to have a consultation with somebody from SCOPA or the Appropriation Committee. What I understand it happens with unauthorized expenditures. Unauthorized expenditures, it's a problem that needs to be fixed, either by asking for the money to be brought back and somebody is responsible and needs to pay for it, or by authorizing it. It says approving it. Now, how do you authorize it? There is approval of SCOPA, and as I understand it, then there is again the adjustment, the Appropriation Adjustment Act, which fixes it, so that at the end, everything is authorized. Section 216, it is there. If it is true that what we are dealing with falls under Section 216, and it is covered by it, then we don't need this. this would seem to me that goes beyond what is covered by Section 2 and 6. And I've noticed this gap between what is the practice and what is the law, because it is not the department, it is not the treasury which commits funds. Presentation, you heard? We commit funds, the department commits funds. We commit funds. Nobody but Parliament can commit taxpayers' funds for any purpose. And obviously we don't do that, but formally speaking we do that. The reality is that all the departments give us the budgets, we approve them, we have never changed the budget, but now this Parliament is beginning to gear itself up to actually do that. But the power lays with Parliament. So I don't want to relabor the point, I just suggest that we do speak with people who have been working on the Money Bill, on the Money Bill Amendment Act and its implementation in Parliament, and are familiar with this aspect of the Constitution.
Saying is that before a department can satisfy the debt granted by a court, Parliament must approve it.
if he hasn't budgeted for it,
yes, or if, I'm talking about,
or if he's severely under budgeted, yes, and Parliament has the power of approving it after the fact.
After the fact.
Yeah, sure. And that's what most of the adjustment appropriation bill is to cover what would otherwise be an unauthorized expenditure. It happens, and then we fix it. It happens all the time. When there is enough need of things to be fixed, either prospectively or retroactively, Parliament intervenes. But at the end, those books need to square out, and everything spent must be somehow be authorized by a law of Parliament.
I'm not quite sure what we would be speaking to Scopa about, and in any event, I mean, the Money Bills, Amendment Bills Act is dealt with by the Appropriations Committee, not by Scopa. So, I mean, there's two issues. I think the issue for me was are we giving Treasury any powers that they don't have? From Mr. Nomvalo's response, it would appear not. They have it already. There would then be an argument for saying, well, you don't need to put it in the bill because they've got it already, but it doesn't. I think it's useful going in the bill so everybody can see how it works. But it's basically then, as far as I can see it, withhold the department's votes, pay it themselves and debit the costs. Those are the two issues in this section. And then, if there are insufficient funds available, that it may relate to a wider period. So I don't really sort of see a problem. I'm not sure how much further we can take it. And we are, look, I'm very anxious that we do not give Treasury any powers that they do not have. In terms of the relationship between Treasury and other departments, they are not a super, they have functions, but they're not a super department. But at the same time, so while that for me is a principle, if we are giving them a greater responsibility with this bill, we need to ensure that they have got the means to fulfill those responsibilities.
For the reasons Steve Swap set out as well. David?
Well, I think the issue really is whether it complies with 2162, whether it's serious or persistent material breach, and I think Mr. Nomvalo has dealt with the issue of whether it's serious, and I think we can go with that.
All right. You want another bite of the cherry, Mr. Nomvalo? Not the orange.
Yes, not the cherry, the pears and the apples. I will leave them too. The only thing though, and I might be a stuck record here, is the part where Treasury actually pays for the department. That's the part that is problematic in terms of the powers the Treasury already has. But I will leave it. I will leave it to the committee to deliberate on that. But that is the power we really don't have.
You don't have.
Paying on behalf of another department.
All right.
Yeah, and that is the power we want them to have.
Yeah.
And that is the power that is in the Makoto order.
Yeah.
Cause a judgment debt to be settled, or itself settle a judgment debt.
Yeah.
And we want that so that payment is made.
Satisfied, made. Yeah.
I mean, remember all of this. The whole purpose of this bill, and to provide for attachment of property, does envisage a situation where Treasury doesn't pay, or the department doesn't pay, Treasury doesn't pay, and then there has to be an attachment. But we want to try and avoid that as much as possible. But that specific power under F, the court order provided it. And we wanted it therefore to continue.
Okay.
I think we should be robust and work from the premise that if it's not prohibited in terms of the Constitution, we can provide it in legislation.
Okay. All right. There are two issues that I want us to apply our minds to, but we'll get there once we've moved beyond this. This has been an interesting debate. At about 12:15, I'll ask Dion to address us on the program, legislative program. And then I want to address you on the Russell Tribunal. I'll explain when I can get there. Janine, I take it you're not quite done, or are you done?
I think we've gone through, the most critical provisions. I'm not quite sure the extent to which the committee would want to sort of go through. Well, subsection 12,
yeah,
deals with a situation where within the current financial year there might not potentially be sufficient funds available to cover the final court order. Then the possibility is provided that the withholding of funds or the satisfaction of the funds affecting a payment in terms of paragraph F could be provided for in terms of an agreement as provided in subsection 5D, and that might potentially cover more than one financial year. This is to address a situation where perhaps a final court order becomes due very late in the current financial year, and so then it would allow for payment to be completed utilizing funds that would be appropriated in the next financial year as well. So it's trying to address that potential situation if it would arise. And subsection 13 emphasizes that when a payment might be affected on behalf of a department, that payment would be treated in a legal sense as being by the department concerned and not as a payment by the Treasury. And so the accountability for that payment would still rest with the accounting officer of that department. And it would not absolve, even if the payment is affected on behalf of the department, the accounting officer would still potentially be liable for financial misconduct in terms of subsection 16 if that happened to be appropriate. And subsection 14 emphasizes that satisfactions of final court orders must be in accordance with this Act, the Public Finance Management Act, and all regulations, instructions, circulars, guidelines, and rules which would be issued by the relevant Treasury. This is particularly envisaging that there would be specific provisions provided in such regulations and instructions and guidelines to address the satisfaction of court judgments extensively. Paragraph B emphasizes that the accounting officer must process the the payment of settlement of a final court order as in accordance with how expenditure is classified in terms of the PFMA, and including as unauthorized, irregular, fruitless, or wasteful expenditure, and then the consequences which arise in terms of the PFMA as a result of the expenditure being classified in that way, such as having to account to SCOPA for the expenditure would then arise. And paragraph D emphasizes that, and D further emphasizes that, all requirements relating to unauthorized, fruitless, irregular expenditure would have to be complied with if the satisfaction of the final court order ended up that it needed to be accounted for in accordance with those categories of expenditure. Subsection 15 emphasizes, places a clear requirement on departments to ensure that they appropriately budget for measures such as contingent liabilities which would arise as a result of claims which have been initiated against the department. So it's trying to ensure that there will be in future appropriate appropriate budgeting to try to address contingent liabilities arising from court orders, so that it will seriously minimize the likelihood that there will not be sufficient funds that have been budgeted for to be able to accommodate court orders, particularly very sizable court orders. Subsection 16 emphasizes that any accounting officer who fails to comply with this section or any applicable regulation, instructions, circulars, guidelines, or directives that have been issued by the Treasury to ensure satisfaction of final court orders and adherence to this section would constitute financial misconduct and would constitute an offense in terms of the PFMA. And the accounting officer, in terms of paragraph B, cannot assign the accountability to ensure the satisfaction of final court orders. So this is clearly intended to ensure that the accounting officer ultimately retains the accountability for the satisfaction of the final court orders.
Mr. Ambrosini, followed by Steve Swart, and then JJ.
A small thing. I think that instead of refer to be contemplated in the PMFA, but not worth a bit.
Steve Swart.
The question is, how do you budget for legal costs? There can be hundreds of thousands of rands. That's part of the judgment. But I suppose it's you do have to do it on the basis of some form of contingent, particularly advocates' fees. We know the process at the moment is the state attorney pays it and covers it later. So there's going to have to be a process in place for an estimation of legal costs, because they can often be sometimes the same amount as the judgment debt itself or the capital. So just we would need to look at that as well.
All right. Can we hear him first and then you, JJ?
Thanks. I think the most difficult problem would be, for example, let me just give an example of the Department of Justice. We've been constantly fighting with the AG in terms of this qualified audits from a budget point of view relating to the contingent liability. The practice, as Honourable Mr. Swartz is raising, that we pay all state departments, then we'll recover. But they don't pay us back. I'm talking about state departments, they don't pay us back. And then what we do, as we process this kind of payment, we've got a zero budget, we go automatically to the overdraft. And this number I can tell you, once you step into that, that's illegal in terms of the PFMA.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now we're making all these payments from the overdraft, which the bank levies an interest already.
Sure.
By the time they pay, we're already on the rent, and some don't. Now, the second challenge is I'm talking about small state departments who don't know whether they'll be sued in that particular financial law or not. Now, they've got to have a particular budget in case. But that litigation can take 3, 4, 5 years, we know. And the expenses incurred throughout that process until the matter is finalized after 3 years, this will go to the Concord. By that time, you've incurred about 7-9 million rand in all the cases that we know now. Now, one case can swipe up the budget of that particular department. Now, what we've lived with it in justice, and we'll explain ourselves and so on, because our contingent liability runs into billions of rands as the Department of Justice, one department. That is over and above the litigation and therefore the Department of Justice itself. Now, I'm not sure whether the same type of latitude from a budgeting point of view will be accorded to other state departments in order for them to pay those judgments. So there are a number of factors that have to be taken into account here.
JJ? Just on Mr. Gawuda's point, I mean, this presentation was meant to be on the part of the administration, okay? Justice and Treasury.
Okay.
So I don't think, unless something new comes up where different components of departments can comment, one expects that one doesn't expect Justice to be then asking questions. Okay. But having said that, I don't see a problem. I mean, having listened to Mr. Gawuda, I don't see a problem with what is there. I mean, it's very wordy. It's very wordy. This section, one wondered how much of it could be in regulations, but given the problems, I don't see any harm in restating it in the bill effectively. So I don't have a problem with what is there and these sections, and I think it's sufficiently general to cover all eventualities and not force anything into any department into a position they don't want to be in. So I don't have a problem with it.
So they stay in debt. State Attorney's Office stays in debt.
All right. Yes, Steve.
This wording will hopefully alleviate that problem, will it? Well, because it makes it very clear that those departments must budget as far as possible and must repay justice. I'm shocked because, budget implications, that is for justice, to carry advocates' fees that are not then reimbursed by the client departments. I mean, that's something we may need to look into at a later stage. That can run into millions and millions of rands.
Debbie?
Sure, it's a problem we've seen throughout the Justice Department, and that is complete lack of management. And this is yet another example. It's quite simple to get ongoing statements of account from your attorneys, from your advocates, and say, please keep us up to date as to where our costs are. It's a very simple thing to do. And you then know what you're looking at, and you can put that in your budget for the following year. These things don't happen over a matter of months, generally. It's at least years. And it's come down to proper management.
Okay. I'm not sure the relevance of what we're discussing now with regard to the bill. Okay. Interesting, as Ms. Munson said, it's problematic, but it doesn't actually relate to the bill.
All right. Mr. Gawuda took the gap, but you have a lot of sympathy, Mr. Gawuda. I'm shocked. All right. What's left is definitions. I
I wanted us to stop at 12:30.
My only concern is I think it's straightforward, because it would be nice to, but there's this one particular section of state, which is the point Dr. Ambrosini was raising, and we've seen it's more complex, and I do think we need to look at that again now. I mean, we obviously need to see these departments, but this definition of state is one that this committee is proposing to put into the bill. That's why it's here. It's not something that was in the original bill.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe as a result of the debate we've had, maybe we should not have this definition. State. Then we go back, it wasn't in the original bill, then we go back to the State Liability Act as it was, and who it applied to, and who it could be worked out as to who it applied to, then effectively stands. We've got a definition of department, which was in the original bill, okay, which is that it's effectively a national provincial department.
And take out the definition of state.
And then if we take out the definition of state, then really all these other bodies that public protectors or whatever then can still be covered, and they can work out how the thing works when they get to court, or somebody else can. Yeah, my worry is that we get the, I mean, Mr. Labuschagne got as far as number 35 out of 40-odd legislation. 40-odd, you say it's the odd that's the problem.
Yeah.
We don't know, and I don't think Mr. Labuschagne knows. Is it 40-odd or is it 50-odd?
Yeah.
And maybe then instead of trying to say this bill, boom, this bill applies only to, we're restricting it to provincial and how we define state, provincial, we've limited it to a closed list of provincial and national departments in the Public Service Act. It's as it was before. We can maybe put in a specific exclusion of local government, because that's part of the Makoro order.
Yeah.
And we, because that was felt to be covered elsewhere. But that would be my main proposal.
All right.
Not that we finalize now, but that we think about that.
Yeah. Removal of state in the definitions. I hope you're addressing me on that, Mr. Ambrosini.
Absolutely. Now, let's leave it as before, but let's see what has changed since it was before. First of all, before was 1957, and since 1957, what has happened has been a huge multiplication of organs of state, and there has been a constitutional provision which has expanded the very notion of organ of state in a manner which many people deem to be problematic, in terms of section 259, 239, 239, whatever it is, anything which is touched with public authority or is established under the law, under the Constitution, it's an organ of state. So this is the scope of application that after the Constitution, the 1957 Act would have, possibly beyond what was intended. Now we are doing something else to the scope of application, which was not in the 1957 Act, which is that of making the provincial treasuries and the national treasury liable for everything. So each and every organ of state in this enormous cosmography of bodies and satellites and commissions, etc. All the liability goes back to there. So it will never be the way it was. We can't unscramble the egg at this point. So if we don't have that limitation to the national and provincial sphere of government, then we need to reconsider at least the definition of treasuries and accept the issue of the Constitutional Court judgment, but we must ask ourselves also what is the rationale of excluding local government when we would be including, as JJ was suggesting, when we will be including the Natal Shark Board and the Johannesburg Zoo.
We've
got that? Yes, but we are doing something that now we will be excluding them. What is the rationale? The Constitutional Court case tells us what is required. We are in the business of creating a new regulation for a matter which is quite important, and we must go beyond the just fixing the which the Constitutional Court requires us to fix. This is a new dispensation. It was done in 1957. We do it now, very likely it's not going to be touched upon for another few decades. So I would be, if we need to do something temporary, I would be comfortable with dealing only with the national and provincial levels of government, making the definition of state a scope of application, and we say this act applies only to the national and the provincial sphere of government, and in those spheres to the department listed in Schedule 1 and 2 of the PMFA.
I mean, our difficulty is we have limited time on this bill. We're not going to create a perfect job. We would have needed more time for that. Although the State Liability Act is a 1957 act, it's been amended. So it's a very short act. It obviously wasn't drafted by any people currently in Treasury. But every section was amended in 93. Okay, so you can't talk of it as being an old 1957 act. You can talk about it as
we can't call it an apartheid act.
Well, 93 was pre new constitution, but it's definitely more recent. Now my concern is okay. The Nyati originally included local government because there wasn't clarity. Then it had to have a relook, and it got specifically excluded because it was already covered. I think it would be useful making that reference. Also, particularly because there are a lot of claims against local government, and there needs to be clarity. We don't want anyone confused that they can use this act as far as local government claims. But, you know, with respect to the Voortrekker Museum, I don't think, and even the Sharks Board for that matter, there aren't exactly many civil claims. And so it's basically saying, look, we're leaving that section that aspect as it is. Okay, we don't think it's particularly appropriate. We think it's a bit onerous on Treasury, but in actual fact, there aren't going to be any. They don't, you know, none of that list we got from Treasury. There's no, there's none of these other organs of state. They're departments. So given the time pressures we're under, let's not tamper with it. If we start having a closed list as we were proposing with this definition of state, then we just don't know what we're leaving out. And there's Debbie's points around the public protector didn't bother to come and make submissions here because she thought she was covered. She couldn't have her property attached. Now suddenly, we've excluded her from the List Liability Act, and you can go and attach her property or any of the other 35 or whatever, maybe 60 bodies. So it's basically that local government, because there's clarity on that, and it'll make it easier for easier reading that it's excluded. And Treasury, provincial and national treasuries don't have to worry about that. It's a different sphere of government anyway. But everybody else, we're not changing it. It would have been better to, but given the time restraints that we've got and the processes we might have to follow, it's better leaving it as it was, which is sort of fairly open-ended. But we know in reality that there are, the likelihood of claims against those bodies that have to use this act are extremely limited.
Okay. So on that point, I mean, if we leave the department, I mean, would not the definition of department as a national provincial department have that effect anyway, at the end of the day? Maybe if we are going to just have a bit of feedback from the legal advisors, they can just address their minds to that issue as well. Whether it will and whether it's a problem if it does. Because, I mean, my thing is just the State Liability Act applies in terms of legislation. You can't just take it away. So whatever the exclusion was there in terms of the previous legislation, so then the protections must be there in terms of the new legislation, I think.
All right, just bear in mind JJ's proposed amendment of removing state as definition.
The exclusion of local government, yes, am I understanding that?
Sorry, Dean Smith. You don't have to say
anything. This is the last one.
You know,
don't get hung up. The organ really is problematic, and frankly, we should amend it. But. No, me. But that's really actually what I want to say. It's healthier to think of the kinds of bodies where one should think in terms of where they should be applicable. The reason the organs of state was invented, as memory says, it became very fashionable then, the concept of public power. It's really an administrative justice provision. And the modern state is a thing that has grown beyond the traditional executive departments. This is true. But the idea of institutions exercising public power, I think people felt quite strongly that they should exercise administrative justice and not so much be held accountable in other more traditional financial and other terms. And so it was a kind of a new idea about public power and the growing state. And I don't think it follows at all that every single time you deal with something to do with the state broadly, the whole damn bang shoot has to be written into every bill, as we're dealing now with the intelligence bill on justification of national security information. They've made it applicable to the entire organs of state, which is now spending years trying to dissuade them from that. So the organs of state doesn't. There's a distinction drawn between section 238, which is about executive organs of state. And then I think the exercise worth doing, and I'll go and see if I can find some old paperwork that I have, is to look at the way the state is treated in other parts of the Constitution. I've got something somewhere which is really useful on the topic. But don't get hung up on 239. I would urge you.
I really want to bring this to a close, Mr. Adams.
I mean, I think that this question stands. And it needs to be answered. I mean, or at least I think we need to understand it better.
Mm.
Because what she says, if I understand it correctly, on the one hand, I mean, we cannot disregard Section 239. It's not a matter of getting hung up or not hung up on the Constitution. That's the definition for the Constitution, for the entire Constitution. Definitions apply to the entire Constitution. So on the one hand, this thing will be applicable beyond the national and provincial Department of State. On the other hand, the entire construct with departments, with treasures, with treasuries, the entire nomenclatura used in the bill, it's only relevant within national and provincial Department of State. An organ of state like a commission or the Natal Park Board or whatever will not have nomenclatura which is similar to the one we utilize here. So if it needs to go beyond the national and provincial departments, then we need to have definitions. We need to have more definition, which will explain that the department means this and includes that as relating to other organs of state.
JJ.
You have to respond. I mean, look, unfortunately, that applies to the existing act. Okay, I'm trying to find it now. It basically, clause. I've got the act. Okay, claims against the state cognizable in any competent court. That's general. That clause is saying then proceedings to be taken against minister of department concerned. Okay, know that. The existing act that we are amending does envisage departments.
Yes.
Okay. So really, we are looking at well, it was Act 2001 of 1993. So I think that the then Parliament had probably legislated the interim constitution. Well, the similar anyway, doesn't really matter. But the bottom line, Chair, is it's leaving. I agree, it's a grey area. But my argument is we do not have the time available to us to ungrey the area, and therefore it is leaving things in that regard as they are.
All right, I'm going to bring this to a close now. You can marshal your thoughts for tomorrow's meeting. The venue for tomorrow's meeting is the same committee room at 9. I'm going to ask Mr. Radman to address us on the legislative program and where we stand with the bills that are currently before us and that we have given his drafters certain instructions on.
Thank you, Chair. I'll only deal with those bills that the committee has been working on. Firstly, it's the Protection of Personal Information Bill. We have drafted the amendments required by the task team and we are ready to go back with those amendments to the task team or the committee, as you may decide. The task team also raised three issues that they needed us to do further research on. We are working on that and we will be ready by next week to inform the committee of our views, or the task team of our views on those issues that they have raised. The trafficking bill, we have a working draft dealing with the amendments required by the committee. We are fine-tuning that and we should be ready by next week to present you with documents in this regard. You will recall, Chair, that the NPA also requested an opportunity to brief the committee and the committee was amenable to that. They have made a number of suggestions in the document that they gave to us and we have not affected those amendments yet. Our view is that we should wait for the committee to decide on those amendments proposed by the NPA. And perhaps it would be a good idea, Chair, if you would allow the NPA to make their presentation first before we finalise our document containing the amendments. And then the third and the last bill that the committee has been working on is the Protection from Harassment Bill. We have a working draft, Chair, and we are ready to present whenever you call us to do so. And then can I just mention that the Superior Courts Bill and Constitution Amendment Bill will be formally tabled in Parliament either today or tomorrow. That is now together with all the comments that we received of the publication of the Constitution Amendment in the Gazette. And then we are on the verge of also introducing the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill.
Any questions for clarity, Honourable Members?
May we assume that the constitutional AB and the superior to be tabled today are the same as those which we kindly received via our committee secretary? There would be no changes a few weeks ago, a month or so ago? They would be the same, presumably? They are covered by a letter from the minister to the speaker.
Yeah. Chair, as far as I can remember, what happened was the bill was tabled in terms of the rules of parliament when it was approved by Cabinet. It was then published in the Gazette for comment as required by the Constitution, and subsequent to that publication and as a result of the comments that we received, there were a few minor changes made to the bills.
Any further questions, Honourable Members? All right. Honourable Members, just two things outstanding. There's an organisation called the Russell Tribunal. It came into being as a result of atrocities that were committed in the Vietnam War. Currently, they are focused on the situation in Palestine, Gaza Strip, the West Bank, etc. They have approached me, both formally and informally, to assist them in obtaining the use of the old assembly chamber on the 5th, 6th, and 7th of November of this year for purposes of holding a tribunal. The hearings and decisions of the tribunal don't have any legal effect whatsoever. It's purely symbolic. They've already had sittings of the tribunal in other parts of the world, and they've gone down very well, so I'm told. So, the reason I'm bringing this to your attention is because a former chair of this committee advised me that the best way to do this is for the committee to host the body. Given the fact that Parliament, the presiding officers, have a very strict policy on the use of Parliament's facilities by outside bodies. It's very strict. And so because the Justice Portfolio Committee would in this case be hosting the Russell Tribunal, in other words, we would book the old assembly chamber, the old assembly dining hall, and one or two other committee rooms for the purposes of that tribunal. It would in effect be a committee function, as it were. I do need your mandate, as it were, or approval to do so, to go to the Speaker and the Chair of the NCOP and say the committee believes that we would like to host the Russell Tribunal and for this purpose, and then take it from there. All right. Let me put together something for you in that regard. All right. I didn't want to. House Chair and Chief Whip will ask how this relates to our mandate in terms of Parliament's. Well, human rights issues. All right, I'll put something together for you, for honourable members, so that you can read and see what they stand for and what they've done. Someone else raised their hand.
Colbert.
Dr. Ambrosini? No. Covered. All right. You gave me this one to bring it to their attention or to bring it to my Honourable members, you will have received your invitation by Chief Justice Ngobo. You will have received this?
Yes.
Good. Well, you must formally decide whether we're going as a committee. And on that basis, then that mandates him to go and make the appeals. Sorry? Make a formal proposal. All right, moved and seconded by JJ and Mr. Swan. All right. It's the date is the 8th of July, the time is at 19:30. That's the dinner. I thought that was more important than the other side. 7th till the 10th. And it's at the Hilton Hotel in Sandton. All right. So you have your mandate? All right. Thank you very much. We're adjourned until tomorrow, 9 a.m.